And I have the absolute privilege of introducing one of those friends tonight. You know, I'm going to introduce Mr. If I'm lying, I'm flying. You might know who that is. You got to get it. You got to get this thing. Is that what he says? Well, he's got this thing, I can tell you. You know, Dennis, I've never heard his story except in bits and pieces for the last 11 or 12 years. And I can't wait for tonight. I've been so excited. But Dennis came in as broken and as down as anybody comes into this program of recovery. And to look at him today, after you hear his story, you'll have no doubt that the fellowship and this program of recovery really work. Dennis has had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. I'm sure he'll tell you about his sponsor and his mentor, same mentor I had. And I heard on the Oprah show, there was this girl, woman on it that had won the Biggest Loser and lost 100 pounds or something. She was gorgeous, but she was saying that she didn't like go on a diet. She began to know that she was just going to have to change. And she began to have things happen and make some choices. And she said, when you do, it seems like the universe cooperates. Yeah. And you know, it does seem like the universe cooperates. Dennis got here to Sumter, South Carolina by an unusual route. And we are so privileged to hear him. Listen, if he drops the F-bomb, that's when you really need to lean forward in your seats and listen to this man. He's going to say something really important. You know, I'd like to stand up here and tell a story about Dennis, but I'm not going to do it. I'm going to leave that to him. Dennis, come on. Y'all welcome. Yay!
About time. Yeah, it's the longest 2 weeks, 3 weeks I've... Oh, man, oh, man, oh, man, oh, man. Hey, I'm Dennis. I'm an alcoholic. Oh, man. Ooh-wee. You know, it's like been 13 years, and this is the first time I'm doing this home, you know. Everywhere else, never here. Bits and pieces, yeah. My story is not an unusual one. I mean, you all have pretty much gone through some of the same things, you know, except, you know, I was a sneak. I was in the closet about a lot of things. I was hide and seek. That was me. I was clandestine. I was nighttime. And in the daytime, I was like, you know that story about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde? That's about alcoholism. Check it out sometimes. But that's kind of like what I was. And I was a liar. God, I was a liar. See, I'm supposed to share with you in a general way what I was like and what happened to me and what I'm like now as a result of what has happened to me. And so I'll try to do that. And I'll you know, I really thought a lot about this, and you know, so I'll try not to get too graphic about stuff, and you know, and I mean, because you all know. Anyway, that's all. I was born, I'm 56, I'll be 56 this year. I was born in a little town called Stanton, Virginia. And I'm the oldest of four children, two boys and two girls. There were two girls in between me and my little brother. He's the youngest. I had wonderful parents. I mean, almost idyllic circumstances. You know, my mom and my dad were always there. And everything was, as far as I can tell, normal. I did all the things that, you know, kids did growing up. But I can tell you, early on, I was very, 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 very self-conscious. I mean, so self-conscious that sometimes it was immobilizing, you know. I always looked at the other kids, and I always suspected, and I don't even know where this comes from, because this is the only thoughts that I've ever had, you know, being young, so I didn't have anything really to compare it to, you know, but I always felt different. I never felt like it looked like the other kids felt, you know, how they were playing and everything and so forth and so on. And, you know, something happened to me. One of the earliest things I can remember that started this this life of secrecy and undercoveredness and, you know, hiding and drinking. We had a chicken coop out in our backyard, and I was about 6 years old, and I had little brothers and sisters. All of us are about 2 years apart going back down the line. And so, we were out playing in our back lot, and we had a chicken coop in the back lot, and there's no chickens in it. Most of the kids in the neighborhood, we all use it as like a playhouse. And we had all kind of grapevines and cherry and pear trees and stuff like that from what I can remember. But I can remember this one day, me and a little girl that lived down in back of us on the next street, down back across the lot, we were in this chicken coop, and we were playing, and she was about a year or so older than me, and she kind of like started doing things to me in this chicken coop, and I was like, you know, I mean, I'm only 6 years old, I don't know, but she started doing things, and I participated, I was very curious. I was always curious, I think I was too young to know anything, but somehow I knew that we were doing something that wasn't right, because we were doing it in secret, you know, and we were doing it in one of the little rooms in the chicken coop. And make a long story short, you know, something had to be going on with this little girl, even in her own personal life, grown-ups, you know, taking advantage of her, because she knew things that you know, a little 7 or 8 year old girl isn't supposed to know. And but that started my life of secrecy. That started my life of I don't even know how it's all started, you know, and it kind of progressed from there. But when I was about 9 years old, I had my first drink. Me and a fellow named Billy Cole, we were up at his house. He lived up in like the next little neighborhood up from us in Oberlin. This is Pennsylvania, by the way. I was born in Virginia, but we moved when I was 6 years old to Pennsylvania. And we were playing, and he brought out a bottle, and he brought out some bananas, and he brought out some Parliament cigarettes. And I was only 9 years old. We were both about eight or nine. We got between the hedges of the house, in front of the house, and we commenced to smoking cigarettes, being like grown-ups, you know, and drinking. And I remember, and the bananas were to cover up the smell. Where do we get this crap, you know? But anyway, I remember my first drink, It was a brown liquor. I believe it was bourbon. It's in a bottle. And I drank it where he drank it first. And I drank some. And as it was going down, I was like, I was looking for my breath. I was like, and I was, and it went down, and it went down, and it, and I was like, whoa, and it came back up, and it went up back into my head, and behind my nose and my eyes started watering. I was like, and it went out my body, my arms, you know, and I was like, oh my God, and what a feeling, you know. And I knew, whoa, this is the way I'm supposed to feel. And I felt good. I mean, I felt good. I felt like I'd never felt before. I felt better than good. I felt like this is it. You know, even at 8 or 9 years old, I kind of sensed this would not be the last time I do this. You know, but I had a real strict father. And at the time, he opened up a janitorial, family janitorial service, and where we did contract cleaning and cleaned up restaurants. And at 9 years old, I started working almost full time, you know, 7 days a week for sure, you know, about 4 or 5 hours a night, 6 hours a night. And this was at 9 years old. I started working for my dad full time. You know, they got laws against that. I've come to find out, I wish I'd have known way back then, you know, because, you know, I mean, of course, I was not happy about it. All the other kids got to do what they wanted to do, and I had to come home from school, do homework real quick, get something to eat, get in bed, and try to get a little bit of rest to go to work. And those are my earliest memories of my family life, my father and my mom and, you know, my sisters and brothers. We worked, and every time somebody turned 9, they got hired on, you know, and I, you know, I got to tell you, we didn't want for anything. I didn't want for anything. I had all the latest this and that and the other, you know, clothes, you know, so forth and so on, little gadgets and shit. I mean, stuff, excuse me. You know, and I enjoyed my life, but I didn't want to be working like this, and I wanted to be out with the other guys, you know, my guys, you know, and I got like 12 and 13 years old, and every now and then my dad would let us go out to special parties in the neighborhood, you know, and it had to be the well-to-do kids. It couldn't be a party down in the projects or something like that, though we snuck down in the projects. That's where I like to go. And when we were out, that's when I would do other things too. We were doing other things by this time, 13, 14 years old, and drink. And I loved it. I love drinking. Drinking was not a bad deal for me early on, you know. But then I'd have to come home from the parties, and I'd have to catch up with my dad, you know, and try to work. And lots of times I was just, you know, throwing up, and he knew what I was doing, but he never rode me about it. You know, I guess he knew, you know. I mean, my dad was a drinker. Oh, my God. My dad was always drinking. But funny thing about it, I never saw what I thought drunk was. I just always saw my dad with a drink, but he was never, a lot of times he'd be sleep laying across the bed, you know, but I figured that's because he was tired and he was working. But later come to find out, you know, he's a controlled drinker. My dad, my grandfather, his dad was full blown, a real alcoholic. And he actually passed from cirrhosis and his alcoholism, untreated alcoholism. But make a long story short, this is how I grew up. I started doing other things that, you know, because of traditions, of course, I won't talk about, but I was doing everything. I loved leaving the way I was feeling and the way I was seeing everything. I loved having courage, confidence. You know, we went to parties and stuff like that, like I said, but I was, you know, I was kind of shy as far as the girls and everything was concerned, but you give me a drink and I was like, I was a lover, you know. And later on, man, you give me a drink, man, my clothes would fall off. You know, that's, you know, and I was a pervert, you know. I'm being honest, you know, in a general way, though. You know, drinking wasn't a problem for me early on. and doing the other things, it wasn't a problem. It was, I had fun. I loved it. I loved being able to get away from my dad, being able to get away from the job and have some fun, you know, with my friends and so forth. But I'd always have to come back to work. And, you know, I look back on that now and the way that we were raised. And I got to tell you, you know, from what has happened since, you know, I look back on that. And I thank my dad and I thank my mom for raising us like they did. I mean, it did slow me down, but it kind of got me off to a late start. You know, 18 years old, I couldn't wait because I was probably going to be the first one, not just in my immediate family, but in all my my aunt and uncle's kids' children to go to college. And this is in about 1972, 73. And I went out to a school in Pittsburgh, art school, and because I'm an artist by actually by training, you know, commercial artist, visual communications, and fine artist. I'm a painter, and so when I went out to art school, you know, all hell broke loose. You know, it was out in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, about 300 miles away from Harrisburg. Big city, or what I thought was a big city compared to Harrisburg, and I got lost in that town. You know, I lived off campus with a group of guys in a house that really was like a commune. You know, it was like about five or six of us guys and about two or three girls in the commune that went with some of the guys, and it was just. It was just perpetual party all the time. And I was doing everything. And I was loving it. I was loving having freedom, nobody to tell me what to do. And only thing is, I can't do that and go to school too. And so my work was good. You know, I'm a painter, but all my other subjects and so forth suffered. And so after about 2 years, they were going to kick me out because... You know, I would just come to class just drunk and high and tripping. This is about 1975. I'm doing everything. Not just, you know, drinking. I'm doing everything. I never did the needle. That's the only thing I've never done. I got to tell you this because this is a major part of my story. It was Easter. I remember it was Easter weekend, and it was like Good Friday. I lived in the university town, Pittsburgh, you know, and I did a lot of partying around Litchfield Towers down in Oakland and Shadyside and so forth and so on. And everybody was gone for like spring break Easter weekend, and it was like deserted. You know, the whole campus was deserted. And I lived in Oakland. And I was living with a girl who later became my wife, okay? And I'll get to that. But I had been tripping for probably like about 4 or 5 days and no sleeping. And I was painting and tripping and drinking. And I painted some real nice. I paint real big, like 4 feet by 6 feet, 4 feet by 8 feet. Paint real large canvases, multimedia, acrylic, and so forth and so on. And I put out about, three or four canvases in about a week's time. And I was going sleep deprived too, of course, because I was not sleeping those 4 days. And I was just drinking, and I was just snorting and using. And I lost all track of time. I lost all track of everything. And I started getting suicidal. And this is what they tell me. And I'm walking around Pitt campus, nobody's there, and I go into this auditorium over in the aviary in Schindley Park or in by Litchfield Towers, and I'm sitting in the auditorium, and I'm having thoughts of suicide. I want to kill myself. What had happened was I'd been reading the Bible, and I was in the Book of Revelations, and that's not a good part of the Bible to be in, even if you're not tripping and drinking, you know. I mean, it's talking about all kinds of things like second death, the lake of fire, resurrection, and all like this. And so I'm like real fixated, you know, because I got that kind of mind, you know. I'm thinking, well, then you know, what's the point of all this? Why don't I just kill myself? So I broke an ashtray and a glass ashtray in one of the lecture rooms, lecture halls. I had all the lights off and everything. And I just wandered into this and I cracked it and I started cutting my wrists and I was sawing my wrist going across like this. People later told me that if I had gone this way, I'd have probably died. But I was going this way and blood just started spurting out. And I was depressed. I was, you know, there was just no point in living. I'm only like 20 years old at this point, you know, 20, yeah, about 20. And, but as I was cutting, I was saying, well, you know, if God really wanted me or wanted to show me what life was all about through death, what's the whole point of life? And that question with no answer caused me to stop cutting, you know, kind of saved my life, you know. And but I walked out and I'm still staggering around, and I remember coming across Shenley Bridge, which is one of the very, very high train bridges in Pittsburgh. And something told me to, you know, something told me to get up on the rail and jump. So I'm climbing over the rail, or I'm up on the rail, and no cars are coming across the bridge. This one car came across and they saw me, and all the people jumped out and they grabbed me and pulled me off and threw me in the car, and my arm was dripping and everything. I had put masking tape around my arm, and they threw me in the car and they asked me where I live, and I just kind of pointed, you know, to get there, I guess. I couldn't you know, this is when I started kind of like blacking out. I remember getting back to the apartment. I remember Dana, who's my, who soon became my wife, and she just flipped and called my parents back in Harrisburg, and the bleeding had stopped on my wrist, and so she rushed me down to the bus station because my dad and mom told her to put me on a bus, and that's when I went back to Harrisburg. I don't know what happened back in Harrisburg. That whole thing was a blackout. And I got to tell you, I was having blackouts for like even weeks after that. Almost a year I was having blackouts and flashbacks and so forth. I got back and I was shaking back at my parents, I remember, and make a long story short, I guess I came to there, and I don't know how long I was home, but they thought I was good enough to go back back to Pittsburgh and back to school and so forth. And I felt okay. And I went back. And when I got back, my girlfriend, who, like I said, became my wife, she had started Bible study with Jehovah's Witnesses. And they were sitting there in the apartment when I came in. And I was like, oh, man, what? How could she do this? You know, I knew what to do with Jehovah's Witnesses. They knock on the door and you just open up, give them a quarter, take the magazines and throw them in the trash can. That's what everybody does, you know. And but they were in there and I just started running off at the mouth and then blowing reefer smoke in their face and, you know, drinking and I'm just, you know, just being an ass. And I had all these questions and they started answering them. And to make a long story short, they told my wife that she'd have to leave me because we were living in sin. So I married her, you know, and I started going to meetings with her, you know, and I eventually became a Jehovah's Witness. Now, of course, Jehovah's Witnesses, no drugs. And but the nice thing about it, alcohol's okay. You just never get drunk. Or if you get drunk on a continual basis, they will disfellowship you. And so thus started my years of being a Jehovah's Witness in the daytime, controlled drinking. And then at nighttime, when I go out and do my work, you know, I inherited some accounts from the Family Janitorial Service after we moved back to Harrisburg with my new wife and family. I started having kids and everything. Make a long story short, that started my life. And this descent into oblivion. You got to imagine, you know, the activities of Jehovah's Witnesses, knocking on doors in the daytime, selling Watchtower and Awake magazines and conducting free home Bible studies. And I was into all that. I was doing all that. I was living two separate, distinct lives. And everybody believed me in the daytime. And I was just, you know, I would always have a drink, but I would never be drunk during the daytime. And I could not wait for the nighttime to come where about 10:30, 11 o'clock, I could get in the car and I could leave and go do office cleaning. I had offices, like lawyer offices, daycare schools and stuff like that in my accounts. And I worked by myself. thus started my life, you know, in the shadows, in the dark, drinking, drunk at night, just doing anything I wanted to do because I felt so free and I felt so good and I felt so away from everything that was controlling me. And then in the daytime or later on the night, I try to rush to get all my work done, you know, get, you know, 7-8 hours of work done in about 2 or 3 hours. And I was drinking in these places. I was doing all kinds of things in these places, you know, cruising the streets at night and bringing people in, you know, to the places that I was cleaning, drinking, and doing everything else I wanted to do. Like I said, I became very promiscuous. I was always promiscuous. But I mean, I was, I'll just say I was shamelessly twisted, you know. During the day, I'd be knocking on people's doors with my little kids and my briefcase and my wife and looking like everything is hunky-dory and afraid of the doors opening up and somebody being behind the door that had seen me like the night before. Just like our book says, you know, we're so afraid when people, you know, when we're out and we black out and stuff like that and drive around and in blackouts and whiteouts. And I'm like, you know, this is my life. And I did this for like almost 10 straight years. I couldn't believe, and it just turned and turned and turned. And I was doing all kinds of things out late at night and then trying to act like I was whatever else during the day. And the dichotomy between the two personalities, they became so distinct and pronounced that I was who I was during the day, but I was who I was at night. And I got real, 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 real sick. Well, one night I'm driving around and I'm stark naked in a car and I'm drunk out my head. It's about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, I think. And I'm driving around and I don't even know why I'm naked. You know, I didn't even notice I was naked until I pulled up at an intersection at the foot of Reservoir Park by Parkside Cafe and Big Street, State Street. And I pulled up and a cop pulled up alongside me, stopped. He looked over at me and I looked at him. And then I'm like, you know, I got open container too, you know, but I'm naked. And he looked at me and he said, I looked at him and then I looked at myself and I said, oh my, you know. And next thing you know, he pulls his car around to block me off from moving. And then he's on the horn and all these cop cars come and pull up. And they put me in the car and they take me down to a hospital first, you know, to make sure I'm all right, you know. And the next thing you know, I'm on the fourth floor of the Polyclinic Medical Center and in restraints and shaken out. And that's where I detox in a psych ward. It's a psych ward. And they locked door psych ward. And I don't know how long I was there. I think I was there about 2 months, almost 3 months. And I was, oh man. And they were trying to figure out what was wrong with me, you know. The alcohol is one thing, but they were wondering what else was wrong with me, you know. And this is when things really started to turn for me. I really wanted to drink. I wanted to drink without any interference from anybody. And so I I got, I have to tell you, I fell in love, so I thought, with this girl in the psych ward. And so my plan was that I was gonna leave my wife. I was gonna leave my four kids, and it was horrible. I remember one night I was out, and this is how, you know, nasty this is. Our disease is nasty. But I'm out, right, and I'm drinking one night, and it's cold. It's in the wintertime, and my family was trying to call me on the phone in each of the places where they thought I was, and they could never catch up with me until finally they caught up with me, and they were trying to call me to tell me that the house had burnt down. And so I'm rushing home, you know, trying to straighten up and pull up the street, and it's real, you know, it's dark. It's like 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. And there's a whole crowd of people standing out in the street, and it's raining on them, and it's real cold. So, you know, there's, you know, people breathing. I remember that. And I remember all the umbrellas, and in center of the umbrellas was my little kids, and my wife had blankets around them and stuff, and flames were just jumping out the house. And I came pulling up, and they looked at me, and they said, "D, where were you?" And, you know, of course, I couldn't tell them. You know, I was working. "Well, how come we couldn't care? You know, this is, I said, "Is everybody all right?" Now, I felt like shit, you know. And so I had a lot of guilt, a lot of shame, a lot of remorse, a lot of visions of stuff at night. Then trying to live and be straight during the day, and the elders finally found out what I was doing. She finally found out what I was doing, you know, when the cops picked me up and put me in the hospital. And make a long story short, I didn't want to go back home. You know, I didn't want to live that square life. I wanted to drink, and I just wanted to do what I wanted to do. And I was so fucking, I mean, excuse me. So selfish, so self-absorbed, self-centered. I mean, and so I left, and I tried to move into an apartment house that was just near my kids, because I still wanted to be a father to my kids. I just didn't want to be married. I just didn't want the restraints, and I just didn't want to keep living that daytime lie. And I just wanted to be who I really was, and who I really was a drunk, you know? And I didn't want nobody to interfere with my right to drink and be who I was. While I was in this apartment, my wife even came up to me, and she made one final stand. She opened up the door, and she said, I opened up the door to the apartment. I had a drink in my hand, and she's standing there in a red dress with red lipstick on, real pretty woman anyway. I mean, so pretty. And she's standing there, and she's begging me, "D, please come home." And I looked at her, and I didn't want to go back into that. You know, I felt, for the first time in my life, I felt like myself. I didn't have to lie to nobody. I didn't have to misrepresent, and I didn't want to go back into that. And I was causing them so much shame. I mean, you know, they disfellowshipped me from the congregation while I was in the psych ward, you know. So I felt free, and I didn't want to go back, and I didn't. And she looked at me. She said, "D, come home." And I said, you know, and I had to drink, and my hand was on the door, and I just slammed the door, and left her out in the hallway, and I could hear her out in there crying, you know, and that was it. That was the end of my marriage of 14 years with my children's mother. But I was free. Boy, all hell broke loose. I did anything I wanted, wherever I wanted, how I wanted. I mean, I lived downtown. I had to move downtown. Oh, I got married, and 6 months or 8 months after that, and that only lasted about 8 months, and I was just going from one catastrophe to another. I was losing jobs. I lost a real good job with Hilton Hotel, where I was executive housekeeper, you know, and it was just all downhill from there. And every time I'd get a little girlfriend or something, my wife remarried, but even though she remarried, she'd still be on my doorstep every time I was dating somebody else, yelling and screaming at me. And then fights would break out. And finally, you know, in my trying to see my kids, she would use it, the kids against me and so forth. And finally, she got a restraining order against me to even talk to her or the kids. And a lot of stuff she could prove, too, that I wasn't a fit father and I was doing weird, kinky things. And so, you know, I was a danger to being around my own kids. And I couldn't take it anymore. So finally, me and my girlfriend, we decided we're going to move out of Harrisburg and move to Stanton, Virginia, where I was born. And I was drinking like a fish everywhere I went. You know, I was drinking, working, drinking, stealing liquor out of the housekeeping closet. I had the key because I'm the housekeeping executive assistant. You know, I was a schmuck. I was a real nasty, underhanded person. Everybody I came in contact with, I tried to subvert my boss so that I could get her job, and I was doing all kinds of things. Finally, they fired. Well, they didn't fire me. They looked at me and said, "Look, we're gonna give you the option to go on the clock instead of being paid salary." And I said, "Well, you know, this is how grandiose I was." I looked at him. I said, "You know what?" I said, "I'm going to take a couple personal days, and I'll get back to you with my answer on whether or not I accept this." And they said, "You got to accept this, or you don't have a job." I said, "Well, I got to think about it anyway." So Monday, I came back with a suit on and all clean and everything, cigar, and I thought I was the shit, you know, and, you know, fucking lush. I sat down with the AGM, and he looked at me. He said, "Dennis," he says, "look," he says, "yeah, I feel really bad." He says, "You're a great guy." He says, "But you got to do something about your drinking." And I said, "Well, Mr. Reese, I'm going to resign, and I'm, I'll tell you what, if you ever need my services, you know, here's where you can reach me and this and that." And I mean, I was like, I thought I was this. And he looked at me and he just started laughing, and he, you know, and I left out of there, you know, thinking they needed me, you know. Anyway, I get down to Stanton, and of course, because I'm living 8 miles outside of town in my grandmom's house, I got to drive everywhere, and this is where I start getting popped. DUIs left and right, reckless drivings, and so forth and so on. I'm getting ready to get put in jail. The director of VASAP gives me the option, 20 weeks of VASAP, and also court order to AA, and also court order to 2 years psychotherapy. She said that, she says, "Mr. Wormley," she says, "you're a god," this is what she said, and I don't even know this lady, I'm sitting down at the foot of her desk, she says, "you're a goddamn liar, I can see right through you." She says, "you're a drunk, and you need to go to AA, and you need to do everything that I'm telling you to do. If you don't, I'm putting your ass in jail." And I said, "what?" I said, "who is this lady? Why is she talking to me this way, you know?" So she gave me a stack of postcards, and I was supposed to take them to AA meetings. And she says, "by the time I see you next time, I better have a stack, this stack of cards back here on my desk." They were self-addresses stamped to her, and I was supposed to get them signed by whoever was conducting the meetings and drop them in the nearest mailbox. So I played their little game, you know. I'm not an alcoholic. I will admit I have problems with alcohol. But, you know, I mean, anybody could get two DUIs in the same exact place, you know, one right after the other, you know. I mean, anybody could do that. Anybody, reckless driving and so forth. I got a problem with drinking, you know. I was driving around a lot of times, and I didn't even have a license anymore. And they started popping me on that. I mean, they could have put me in jail, but they were really being lenient. I don't know why, but they told me 20 weeks VASAP, which meant $50 a pop at the meetings. I couldn't afford to do that, you know, and live, you know, so I was by this time the girlfriend was gone. I was living in this house all by myself, and I was living in the back room. I didn't have any running water. I didn't have any lights. I had a kerosene heater. And I had 4 buckets on the corner of each corner of the house collecting rainwater to be able to take little baths, because I had the bowl on top of the kerosene heater. And I was so lonely. I was so hopeless. I was angry. I was ashamed. I was really ashamed and really guilt. You know, my kids, all I kept seeing was my kids. I had no way to tell my kids I loved them. So I tried as best I could to make sure the child support was being paid. And I didn't have lights. I didn't have anything. And I didn't have a license. I'm riding a bike 8 miles in and out of town to try to go to work. And then by this time, the only jobs I could get was, you know, in restaurants where, you know, I could drink, you know, and work. And this was all I could do. And so this is what I was doing in Stanton, Virginia. And by the time everything happened and I ended up in AA, this was my life, you know. And so I'm working in a place called L'Italia, which is a fine dining restaurant. You have to wear a tie, cummerbund, and dress shirt, you know, tuxedo shirts. And so I had all this packed up in my little knapsack riding into work on my bike. And I was clean as a board of health. I'm still delusional, thinking I got it going on, and I ain't got shit going on. And then I take my little bike and my knapsack up the street, go across the street, and climb those 48 stairs to the top of a bank building where they had the Stanton Group AA, and carry my bike and everything up the steps. I was in shape then, you know. And that was my life, you know, going to AA meetings and listening to them old brown guys, country guys. I was in the country in Stanton, and there's just nothing but truck drivers in the meetings, farmers and cats that rode motorcycles and shit like that, and old guys, a lot of them no teeth, brown, you know, because of the cigarette smoke in the room. I remember coming up in the room, and I had my tie and cummerbund on and everything, and I was all slip, hip and cool, like so I thought. And I'll come into this, and I look, and there under the lights, way in the back of the room, you know, sitting at this table was all these guys and a cloud of cigarette smoke. You couldn't almost see through it. And a guy welcomed me at the door. His name was Bill Robertson, who was a school teacher. And he had a tie on, which kind of impressed me, you know, standing at the, he was a greeter. You know, a lot of groups don't do that anymore. But, you know, if it wasn't for that guy, I might not be here. You know, I mean, I look at a lot of things that if it weren't for, I might not be here. He put his hand around my arm and shook my hand and said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous," and pulled me into the room, you know. And I looked. And I'm like, what the hell? You know, and I see all these old guys, and I go sit down, and I got all this judgment thing going on, and, you know, I'm angry, and I'm looking at these, and I'm saying, Miss York, you know, like, how do I end up here with these guys? You know, and I'm, you know, and so I sit down, and I'm looking at these guys in judgment, you know, and what can these guys do for me? You know, and I start listening. And make a long story short, I'm making 3 meetings a day. I want to satisfy Miss York, and I want to get off this thing, and I want to get out of this VASAP thing, and I want to get, you know, and I'm getting out of all this. So I figured the more meetings I went to, the more happier I make her, the quicker she'd get me off all this. And that's the only reason, you know, early on. But I'll tell you what, that kind of like one of the things that saved my ass, you know, going to 3 meetings a day in between shifts at work down the street. And that was my life for about the next 3 or 4 years. But I got to tell you, those guys started turning on me. I mean, they put up with me, and they put up with my shit. Yak, 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 yak. You know how newcomers are. You know, yak, 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 whining. They put up with me. And, you know, I mean, I didn't know how I looked to them, but I, you know, now in looking back, I said, "Is that me?" Because I look at the, yep. I said, "Damn, I was fucked up," you know. But anyway, I'm looking at these guys but I'm listening to them, and you know, all these meetings you know, I'm trying not to have any kind of a social life, because if I go out, I'm out, you know. So I stopped all that, and I'm trying to just make meetings, going to work, and riding out that road to get home, and trying to stay straight and trying to do the right thing and so forth and so on, and try to get out from under this wrap I'm under. And that's for no other reason. That's what I did. But, you know, these guys, a lot of them, they keep saying the same thing over and over. I remember one guy named Charlie. He's an Indian. And he says, my name is Charlie Nicely, and I'm a real alcoholic, and rarely have we seen a person fail who get himself a good piece of tail, you know, and I'm like, yeah, and everybody busts out laughing. I'm like, what the hell are they laughing about? This shit ain't funny, you know, and he'd just be cutting up. And I seen this cat around town, you know, I thought he was a derelict, you know, he didn't have no job, like a bum, but he was on a disability, but this cat had 15 years. And the more that I listened to him and some of the other guys, the more, you know, these guys were spiritual giants. I mean, they talked about God, but they just didn't talk about God. Their God was keeping them from drinking. And these cats is real alcoholics. And if you read the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know that a real alcoholic can't do that under his own power. I couldn't do that. And I'm looking and I'm seeing, and what did these cats have? They had something. They were laughing and having a good time, and I'm fucking miserable. I'm just trying to do what I got to do. And anyway, I'm listening, and I'm doing all these meetings, and then pretty soon I get caught up in the socialness of the group, which I'm telling you something, the fellowship is a very, very powerful thing. Don't underestimate the power of the fellowship. Because I was staying sober at this time, just probably off the fellowship alone. I hung out with these guys, went with these guys. We went to meetings afterward, coffee, went to the Waffle House. Sometimes we went bowling, you know, late at night, you know, and then, you know, I'd have to take that ride home, or sometimes they'd ride me home in their vans with my bike in it, you know, and I got real close to these guys, and these guys turned into like real, real close friends. And I can't believe sometimes when I look back at how I judged these guys, but they took care of me and they put up with me. And finally, when I started coming around, I'll tell you what started me coming around. Now the book says that we become angry, irritable, and discontent after not having drank a while, but not having a solution. That was happening to me in AA. But I don't know it's happening, because it happened over so slow a period. I'm not feeling any better than I did when I come to a meeting. I used to come to meetings and always feel better after leaving meetings, but I'm not anymore, and this thing's starting to go flat, and this thing is starting not to be any fun, and I'm starting to find fault with everybody, everything, and I didn't know what was happening to me. So I'm sitting in this one meeting. This 20-year-old kid named Gene Crossan is chairing a meeting, and he's chairing it on the fourth and the fifth step. This cat only had 9 months. And I had almost 18 months sitting on my hands, you know, and trying to do everything they told me to do, but I wasn't doing anything. I really wasn't doing anything. I hadn't cracked a step, and I don't like that fucking book. You ever read that book? That book don't make no sense. It don't have no beginning. It don't have a plot, you know? I mean, it has a cast of characters, but I mean, everything's so totally unrelated. And that, what about that chapter, we agnostics? What the hell is that about? We agnostics. You know, and it doesn't have an ending, you know. And so, I mean, I tried reading it. It just don't read right. But Gene Crossan had taken the steps, and he had just taken the fourth and the fifth step and was chairing the meeting on it. And this cat was on fire, 20-year-old kid, real tall kid, one of them, you know, skater dater kids, you know, skateboard with the baggy shorts and the chain and, you know, and he's homie wannabe, you know, and he had this ball cap. With the top cut out and his hair just shot out, fire engine red and yellow. And he was shaved and had it dyed black, and his eyebrows were dyed black. And he had earrings on his eyebrow, okay? And then he had them going up his ears and tattoos and stuff like this, 20 years old, you know? And he was just, but he had these real electric blue eyes, man. And he just chaired this meeting, and this cat was on fire. And I know this cat was on fire. He looked good. But he didn't look like I look. He didn't look like I felt, you know. Something was going on with this kid. And so, anyway, he gets up after the meeting. He runs around the table, and he says, Dennis, what the hell is going on with you? And I said, what do you mean? And the people are still sitting there, and he's embarrassing me in front of all these people. I said, what do you mean? He said, Dennis, he said, I'd heard you share. He said, you shared that you were still on the third step. He said, how are you on the third step? He said, when I came in here this time last year, you said you were on the third step. What are you doing? And I looked at him, and for some reason, I didn't slap this little boy, embarrassing me in front of these people. And I said, No, I'm really not doing anything with the steps. He says, Dennis, he says, God, he says, you don't look so good and you don't sound so good. And I'd swear, if I didn't know any better, I'd swear you're on your way back out, Dennis. And I looked at him, I said, you know, I'm really? And I'd seen guys go back out. I know what they look like. I just didn't know I looked like that. But when he looked at me and told me that, I knew, you know, this cat was on fire and I wasn't. And so I say to him, I said, well, and he says, Dennis, he says, you need to get a sponsor. He says, you need to take this fourth and this fifth step. He says, Dennis, if you do this, he says, you will not believe. And I looked at this cat and his eyes were like, and I'm like, damn, you know. And like I say, for some reason, I didn't slap him. Some reason I didn't try to save face or justify or try to lie. I mean, I had a sponsor in name only, a cat named Charles M. from over in the Waynesboro group. Everybody knew this cat, right? And that's why I asked him to be my sponsor, you know, because everybody knew him and he had a good program, you know. And then people would ask me, Dennis, you got a sponsor? Yeah, Charles M. is my sponsor. Charles M. in Waynesboro? Yeah, Charles M. Oh, wow, you must have a good program. I say, yeah. you know, I didn't crack no steps. I didn't read that book. I didn't do none of that stuff. I said I did, but I didn't, you know, and I kept coming to ASA meetings. You know, I did not want to drink and I did not want to go to jail. So anyway, He says, Dennis, he says, if you do that, he says, you will not believe. And I looked at him, and for the first time, I knew something was going on because this kid was bad. He was bad news. I mean, there were nights I walked him home while he was whining, and I'd help him, you know, to get it together and stuff like when he first came in. And now it's kind of like the other way around, you know. And so I looked over at this guy on the other side of the person I was sitting at the table with, and this cat's name was George P. And I was going to ask George P. to be my sponsor right then and there. And here's the reason why. This is how I am. You know, this cat had a suit and a tie on. Okay. He carried a pocket sized big book in his pocket with behind his pens. Okay. He wore wingtips. He had acrylic pants on and an acrylic jacket. And he had these big long teeth, a real tall guy. And had about 4 or 5 hairs on the top of his head, you know, and he was a geek. But this cat knew the book, and he would always introduce himself at meetings because I would hear him. He says, my name is George Peterson, and I'm a real alcoholic. And our book says, and then he'd always go into what the book says, and he'd always go into a step or something like this. So I knew this cat knew the book, and so that's why I asked this cat. I looked at him after Gene said what he said, and I said, George, I said, will you be my sponsor? And he looked at me, and he heard all this, you know, and he looked at me, and he said, Dennis, I'll be your sponsor only on one condition. And I said, oh, shit, what's that? He says, if you're willing to go to any length. And you should have seen me. I had this deer in the headlight look. I'm standing there like this cat was asking me to go to China or something and feed the poor, you know, or serve where the need's great, you know. And, I mean, you know, that sound really extreme if you're willing to go to any length. And so I stood there stunned, and he looked at me, and he saw I was in a quandary. You know, he looked at me. He said, Dennis, he said, there's only one answer to the question. And I'm standing there, and I'm, like, still trying to figure it out. I swear to God, this is how my mind works. I said, now, if I say no, this cat's going to say no, he won't be my sponsor, but I really want him to be my sponsor. I really do got to take these steps, and but now if I say yeah, I'll be lying because I don't know if I'm willing. He looked at me, he said, Dennis, there's only one answer to the question. So finally I just said yes, because I wanted him to say yes to be my sponsor, not for any other reason, you know. So I said yes, and he said good. And the way he said good, he said, it sounded like a Lon Chaney movie. He said good, you know, like that. And I said oh. And he says, and then here he goes. Here's the deal. This is the deal. He looked at me and he said, Dennis, he says, we're going to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous together. And when it gets to a direction, I'm going to call it to your attention because you will not see it. You are inexperienced. And I looked at him and I said, who is this guy? You know, I didn't say that to him. You know, I said, who the hell is it? And then he didn't stop. He kept on going. He says, and when we get to a direction, he says, we're going to stop and you're going to take it. And when I'm satisfied that you have taken it, we'll move on until we get to the next direction. I said, this guy is the hell. And then he just, oh, man. And then he looked at me and he said, and we're going to keep on doing it like that, Dennis. And I said, no, he didn't. He shook his head like a black girl, like, Dennis. And I said, no. And he says, and somewhere in the doing of that, Dennis, he says, you're going to come into contact with a power greater than yourself who will solve your problems. Because I can't. I got problems of my own. And I said, what? And this cat really did have problems. Guess where this cat was coming to meetings from? Western State Mental Hospital. Over in Waynesboro. They gave him a pass to drive his little red van off the estate to come to meetings. You know? and I asked this guy to be my sponsor. Now I'm locked in two psychos. Boy, you know, I mean, God really does do for you what you can't do for yourself sometimes. I look back now, and he's probably the only guy who would have understood me, you know? So one psychopath to another. Yeah, this cat had a breakdown. Yeah, he lost his fortune. He was like a stocks kind of guy, you know, and lived up in Northern Virginia. And he just had a nervous breakdown. His wife left him, and he had two daughters. Everybody just left him. Oh, he still did have a lifetime membership to Pinehurst Country Club, you know, golf course, you know. But anyway, make a long story short, that's what we did. Every Tuesday at Jay Rugel's Warehouse in downtown Stanton, right there on the wharf, places I used to drink, you know. We would sit in the booth, and we'd drink coffee, and he made me buy one of those little big books. I still got the big book, you know, that one. And we would read, and he was right. When we got to directions, I didn't see them as directions. And he would make me underline it, and the same thing that was underlined in his book was underlined in his sponsor's book and in his sponsor's sponsor's book and all the way back to, he did mention Clancy, and that really caught my attention too, because I had listened to tapes of Clancy, you know, so I guess he was in our sponsor kind of like lineage, you know. And you know, people talk like that. He's my great, 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 great grand sponsor. Shut up. You know. Yeah. But anyway, so we read, and when we got to the direction, he stopped and he made me take it. And I loved George, you know, because he only gave me one direction at a time. He knew what kind of mind I had. You know, he knew if he gave me a whole bunch of directions, I'd find some kind of way to screw it up. I mean, fuck it up royally. And I would have, you know, but he just gave it to me one direction at a time. And as we went and as we went and as we went, things were happening for me. It's the damnedest thing. I mean, nothing in that book was about how to pay rent. Nothing in the book was about how to get the wife and the kids back, you know, how to get a good job. Nothing in the book was in there about that, you know, but we just kept on. And for some reason, things were changing for me, you know? Things were changing for me. I'm so sorry. I'm a little over time. Anyway, make a long story short, I don't know if that was a spiritual awakening, but I do recall sitting in a car with Mary Cash after a meeting. She was whining to me about her husband, Lucky. He had just gone back out, and they were trying to be in together, you know, and so forth and so on. So I took her home after a noon meeting, and it was raining. We were at the foot of Afton Mountain going into Stewart's Draft, and we were sitting in a McDonald's, just got a milkshake and a burger, and we're sitting there talking. And, man, my mouth started running, and I started just... And man, it was like, I don't know where this stuff was coming from. I was just like, I was happy. I mean, sickening happy, you know, that kind of happy. And I was overjoyed. And the book, man, was made so much sense to me. Everything, I was just popping off with stuff and trying to help her out. And I was like, where is this shit coming from, you know? And I remember this because it was like a rainy afternoon, and the clouds like set at the end of the at the foot of Afton Mountain, and it's real foggy, and so sun's rays, it's kind of like core, you know, angel and choirs and stuff. Sun rays started shooting through the clouds, everything around us, and I'm sitting there, I'm talking to her, and I just had the feeling, you know how the book says that and our alcoholic condition was relieved, as in fact it proved to be. I mean, the obsession, you know, that had always dogged me. I mean, it was gone. I felt light. I felt I felt like I knew I was going to be okay. And I never had that feeling before, except, you know, like as far back as I can remember, maybe like with that first drink, you know. But I felt, finally, I felt okay. And I was okay in my own skin. And I can tell you, that feeling has not left me since. Even to today, that feeling has not left me. I know everything's going to be all right no matter what. But make a long story short again, I'm now working in a nice job with a cat named Ben Jeter, who owns, he and his wife own the Ingleside Resort. It's a golf resort, and I'm back in my element doing things with hotels, and you know, because that was my work, and I'm doing front desk, I'm doing banquets, I'm even doing bartending. Whoa. You know, I don't recommend that in anybody, but I'm just saying that that's how it was for me. I had to make a buck, man. I was paying child support. I was trying to stay out of jail. I was paying off fines and stuff like that. By this time, I was finally getting my license back. And Mr. Jeter had a daughter. He and Mrs. Jeter had a daughter. Her name Ashley. This place was called Ashley Oaks Apartment Complex, named after her, because they own this property down here, too. They had a lot of concerns, you know. But make a long story short, she's a heroin addict. And she's up there in Stanton working with them, trying to open up this hotel. They pumped about $3 million into this hotel. Real nice place, real nice place. And they had vision. Pat had vision. Ben, he was money, you know, kind of guy. But anyway, make a long story short, they're taking their daughter back to Florida to the boat. To a treatment center or one of those recovery places down there. And they hadn't seen the place. They had sent her to places, but hadn't seen this place. And this place was a dive. And he and Pat riding back up the road after dropping her off. And Ben says to Pat, he says, "You know, Pat," he says, "I am sick of this," because she'd been in places all up and down the East Coast, you know, a lot of money pumped into her and their son, too. They have a son that's an alcoholic. And Ben says to Pat, he says, "Pat," he says, "there ought to be a place where alcoholics and addicts go and pay their own goddamn way through their own goddamn recovery. I am tired of throwing money down a goddamn hole." Quote, unquote. I'm just saying that's how he said it. And Pat looked at him and she said, "Ben," she said, "what about that place we have in Sumter, Ashley Oaks?" He says, "What are you talking about?" She said, "What if we turn that into a recovery place?" And he says, "Pat, we can't get involved in anything else. We're so extended. We got this, that, and we don't even have time for it. Who would do that?" She says, No. Think about it, Ben." She says, "What if we had two people to an apartment, each person have their own bedroom, and they pay $100 a week?" And when Ben heard that, ka-ching. Because, you know, they were getting like $400 and some a month for this place. They're talking, now you're talking about almost $800 a month per apartment. Ben said, He said, "Yeah, Pat, but who will we get to run it?" And Pat said, "Well, what about Dennis? He might be interested in doing something like that." And now I had no experience doing anything like this, you know. But they said, okay. So they got to Concord at her mom's house where they spent the night. And they called me out the hotel and said, "Meet him out to the house on Sunday." Met him out. I said, "What's this about?" And she said, "We can't talk about it over the phone, but it's business." I said, "Oh, no, these cats want to get me started in Amway, you know, because that's the way they do Amway, you know. They don't tell you, you know." So I said, "Okay." So I met him out the house. I'm up there playing with the fat cat by the fireplace. I'm sitting on a ottoman, and they come in, and they say, "Dennis." And they run the whole thing down to me, what they want to do. And I'm just sitting there, my eyes bug wide open. I've been sponsoring some cats and very active in the fellowship, having a ball. I was having the time of my life. When we'd have parties at the drop of a hat in our home group, you know, dances and stuff like that, you know. I was very active and had a lot of young guys. I'd never been involved in anything like this. I said, they asked me if I was interested. I said, "Hell yeah, I'm interested." They said, "Well, what about your other job?" Because I was driving trucks by this time too for a place called Fisher Auto Parts, and I was on vacation with them. And they said, "Can you get a couple extra days?" I said, "Why?" They said, "Let's go down tomorrow." I said, "What?" And well, we didn't go down Monday. I think we came down Tuesday. We came down here. Ben works fast, man. He had called up one of the cats that headed the Oxford houses because he wanted information on how to get started. And this was going to be called so-called Cambridge House or something like that. And so we're coming down the road talking. He had already talked with this cat, Chris M. And Chris said he couldn't get involved because it'd be a conflict of interest with what he was already doing. But he said he knew a guy that was his sponsor that would be very interested in it, had a lot of experience. And this cat's name was Philip R. and Philip Rowland. And when we got down here, we saw the place. We toured Sumter. We went down to Eugene Batten and all them down there at the commission, and we're getting information on how to open up a place. And we were to meet Philip up in Ryan's up in Florence. And so we're going up the road. We get up there, and Philip comes pulling in his van, and he jumps out, and Ben doesn't know him. He doesn't know Philip, but he saw both of us sitting there. So Philip figured it was us, and he came walking up the van. He says, "You Ben Jeter?" He said, "Yep." And I'm looking. I'm behind Ben. I'm looking, and this cat, Philip, oh, my God, he was off the chain. I mean, he had energy, was just jumping off of him. He was all animated, and cussing and everything. And I'm like, "Who is this cat?" And Ben started running it down to him once we got in there about what he wanted to do. And Philip's eyes got big as Coke bottle behind his glasses, because Philip had always wanted to do something like this, you know, kind of like on his own. He had been affiliated with some real nice places, done some real nice work over the years. He'd been in the field at that point probably close to 30 years. And this cat, man, was on fire. And I looked at him, and I'm like, "Who is this guy, this little old guy?" And so anyway, Philip agreed to come on at first as a consultant. That's what he's going to do. And he was going to, because I had no experience, and Ben was going to bring me down here and just plant me here. And then Philip would bring folks in from the treatment centers, because he was doing a lot of consultant work with like Wilmington Treatment, Charleston Center, and all these places up and down the east coast of South Carolina. And they started bringing, he would bring people in, and I'd be here, and you know, I didn't know what I was doing, you know. All I'd do is once they got here, I'd start taking them to meetings, you know. And that's what we did, because there was no meeting hall, there was nothing here. That was a garage with junk in it from past renovations of this whole place. This place was still filled with tenants when we first got here, and they were now on month-to-month contracts until they found a place to be, and they would vacate, and we'd acquire the property. I'd go in and paint, and I painted all these places, had to stock them with furniture and so forth. We had an account with Furniture Warehouse so forth. And I mean, it's a lot of work, you know, it's crazy, and I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know nothing. And all I knew was just take them to meetings and keep on sharing my experience with them and so forth and so on. And until finally we got a community room. Ben sent a crew down here and turned that thing into a community room in about 3 days, a weekend. I was the one who was responsible for loading everything in there. I filled up two long truck bins of junk and stuff in there. I was buff, man, back then. I was like, not now. I'm like, you know, yeah, all broke down. And folks started coming in. Our very first resident's name was Pam. Our next resident was Little Joe. And then our next resident, we even have some of our former residents here, probably like the 16th or 17th residents here. Tracy, if she's here, you know, yep. And all kind of folks. I don't really have enough time to go into what's been happening with me, but I can tell you, you know, I never thought I'd be useful, because I was always taken from people. You know, I was always stealing, lying. I was always, what's in it for me? You know, so I'd never been any kind of, and I mean, seriously, no kind of a giver if it wasn't something in it for me. And I mean, the closest thing that I ever got to being a contributor was being a distributor, you know, if anything, you know. I mean, I didn't know, you know, I never thought about a life of service or a life of being useful to anyone else. This is what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. This is what the fellowship has taught me, watching folks and so forth and so on. Just giving with no motive involved, just for the sheer enjoyment of being happy and staying sober. You know, wow, what a good deal, you know. But this place has over the years evolved, and folks have come and gone, and we've made, like Gene was saying, a whole host of friends. You know, a few years back we lost Philip, and Philip brought us far as he could on his own back, you know, and here we go. And over the years, you know, someone's always showed up amongst you all to take spots in that office and carry us to the next thing, you know. And we've been doing that now for like the last, like I say, 6-7 years. And this place has been open 13 years. I still don't know what we're doing, you know. We don't. You'd be surprised how much we are winging our way through this, you know. You think we know some stuff. I tell you what, we now know that we don't know some stuff. That's what puts us at an advantage. You know, we used to think we knew and didn't know nothing. You know, that, you know, when yeah, that's the way everybody first comes in. You know, this is kind of like the first time I've ever kind of told my story or shared my experience here at any length. I've done it other places, but this has really been a trip. It's really been nice to be able to do it, and I'm so honored. You know, God spare life and the creek don't rise. Come June 1st, I'll have 17 years without a drink, without a drug, you know. Thanks to this program, thanks to the fellowship, thanks to good sponsorship and having real wonderful, I don't even know, how, I mean, because it's actually more than family, if there is such a thing. I mean, you know, I got soul mates, you know, that are walking with me doing this thing like this, and I'm just so fucking lucky, you know. I mean, I can't believe it, you know, but here we go, and we're looking forward to a nice weekend. Hopefully you all will be here tomorrow, and we'll pick it up. Our guest speaker is here, and Kip, welcome. We're glad you're here. And we are so looking forward to your talk. We've heard you a lot on the CDs and stuff like that, you know. We're like, you know, Kipsy groupies. It's for real, you know. I'm so looking forward to it. Glad you're here. Make yourself at home. If there's anything we can do, you just let us know. Just say the word, okay? And y'all, just please come back for tomorrow. And, you know, thanks, you know, for listening and, you know, to me, Cher. And I'm really grateful to be here. And this is, you know, thank you. Thank you.
All right, please help me thank Dennis one more time.